I cannot tell you what a comfort it is tonight to see the faces of so many friends and of those librarians I remember meeting at ALA conventions in years past. One of my earliest memories has to do with public speaking. I must have been 5 or 6 years old when my father took me to the funeral of an acquaintance who lay in state in the offices of the factory of which he had been the president. The minister led the service with practiced ease. A director spoke most eloquently for the board, and the executive vice president of the firm spoke with equal competence. Finally, one of the workers selected to represent the labor force mounted the rostrum next to the open casket. From the beginning, it was quite clear that he was very nervous and unequal to the task, even though he must have learned his lines by heart. He began bravely enough with, "Ladies and gentlemen," but in the face of the large audience, he forgot everything. And just stood there, perspiring profusely, gripping the edge of the lectern with white knuckles, eyes bulging. He started again with, "Ladies and gentlemen." But it was obviously no use. After an embarrassing silence, he suddenly lost his head and bellowed, "Ladies and gentlemen, hip hip hooray!" It was, needless to say, an enormous success and completely changed the mood of the solemn occasion. Standing here tonight, I feel a little like that poor man. And I know how he must have felt. I think I must have come up in the world, though, and I'll tell you why. Some years ago, I was asked to give a talk to a group of librarians at a state convention. It was a substantial affair, and the after-dinner speaker was a distinguished former member of the United States government. The following morning, it was my turn. I was the breakfast speaker. Not even the after-breakfast speaker, but the before-breakfast speaker. Somewhere between the prune juice and the cold scrambled eggs. So you see, tonight, I have arrived. It seems to be a hollow tradition to call recipients of both the Newbery and Caldecott Awards out of bed in the middle of the night, or at best in the very early hours of the morning. I suppose this is calculated to add greatly to the dramatic effect, and in my case this was most certainly true. The phone rang at 4:30 Chicago time, and I picked up the receiver with trembling hands and pounding heart. The first thing that came to my mind was my parents' house is on fire, or that at least someone near and dear had just died. It was therefore an immense relief to hear that Noah's Ark had just been given the Caldecott. Since that memorable morning, I've had 5 months to figure out that whole early calling tradition carefully. It may have nothing to do with the dramatic effect after all, and may be intended as a loving kindness, a safety measure if you will. Picture this. Someone hearing that he or she has won during the day might easily suffer cardiac arrest from understandable amazement, joy, and excitement. By cleverly calling in the dark of night, the committee makes sure they catch you where you should be in case something fatal occurs, in your bed. A few days after being called in January, my wife and I were again called out of a deep sleep. Aha, I thought, won again, and with what foresight on behalf of the committee. This time they're giving it to me, sight unseen, for my next book, which is still at the printers. I was wrong, of course, for a raw voice asked if he was speaking with the Fifth Precinct. It is apparent that the whole thing must have gone a little to my head. In accordance with the instructions I received, my wife and I made our children swear not to tell a soul, and they didn't, although it subsequently became clear that the news had somehow leaked out in other quarters. That same day, on a plane to Chicago, I sat next to an editor I knew. The conversation went as follows. The editor: "Where are you going?" Me: "To Chicago." She: I see. Why?" Me, thinking quickly: "Oh, some Doubleday business." She: "Is it the secret?" Me: "Yes." She: "Congratulations." My contact with Randolph Caldecott, by the way, is of long standing. My father owned a collection of Caldecott's work, most of them first editions. I do not know whether I was showing early promise, but it seems that I took one of those valuable books. I was 3 years old, and with a red crayon expertly ruined each and every page of the book. I do not recall the spanking I was given, although my father assures me that it was fairly meted out. The story has a happy ending for me, though, for when I told him that Noah had won, he gave me his whole collection of Caldecott's books. 25 years ago, I landed my first job as a freelance illustrator in the United States. It was a book for Doubleday, and since that time I have been singularly fortunate in my relationship with my publisher. I want to thank my many friends at Doubleday for always having left me alone to do my own thing without any interference. I want to especially remember the late Blanche Van Buren and the late Seth Agnew, with both of whom I worked closely. I know how lucky I am to be blessed with an editor who also is an old friend, Janet Chenery, whose comments always make sense, even though we do not always agree on everything. At this moment, I'm also thinking of Ole Riesem, a friend of many years who taught me a great deal about the business I'm in. But above all, I want to thank my father, the journalist and illustrator Joe Speer, for the help, advice and friendship he has shown me all my life. To no man do I owe more, personally or professionally. A successful book is not due to the effort of just one man, but it is the result of teamwork. An author-illustrator can create a most appealing book, but that same book then has to run a long and risky gauntlet before it finally staggers into your libraries, if it gets there at all. The editor, with the best of intentions, might make changes which could ruin the book. The company that makes the color separations could demolish the artwork. Inferior paper can undo all the considerable expense, time and effort put into first-class film and outstanding offset plates. The printer in turn could ruin the sheets in countless different ways, and the bookbinder can do the same. And finally, the marketing, publicity and advertising. These, too, can be done the right way or the wrong way. With Noah's Ark, all went well from the beginning, and I do thank all the members of the team for their share in the book. I'm aware how much I owe to the printer George Carnegie and Andrew Knapp and the people at Knapp Litho. The same is true of the people in Doubleday's production department, especially Virginia Muller and Mary Brandt, her successor. There are so many names that come to mind, too many to mention. But I do want to thank Bob Banker, Jack O'Leary and Patty Hinckley in particular. One of the questions I most often asked is, why did you decide on Noah's Ark? The answer is simple, because I wanted to retell the story for years. The final catalyst was the 17th century Dutch poem by Jacobus Revius, which has the faith and above all the childlike simplicity which I found moving and inspiring. It was obviously not an original idea, and I went to our library to look at Bowker's books in print to find out precisely how unoriginal it actually was. There were over 20 Noahs in print. The library owned 7 different versions of them, and when I tried to have a look at them, I found that they were nearly always taken out on loan. So I bought all the versions I could get hold of, to see what other artists had done with Noah. Some were good, others were less so. But I found that virtually all the books had the same slant. The flood was invariably depicted as a joyous, sun-filled Caribbean cruise. Happy flood, happy Noah, wearing a sailor's cap, with binoculars around his neck. Happy beasts, no drowning, nothing to indicate God's wrath. It was difficult to even recognize the Bible text in any of those books, and it was not what I had in mind at all. A few books were a bit more somber, and followed the Bible closely, without adding any unexpected sidelights or intimate glimpses. None of them showed Noah shoveling manure, or even hinted at the stench and the mess inside. It was then that I knew that there was room for one more Noah's Ark. When working on the layout of the book, not in sketches yet, but with written notes, I had the Ark floating away and the waters rising higher and higher, the animals that remained behind standing knee-deep, then waist-deep in the water, as I later showed in the book. The next page showed hundreds of drowned animals awash in the waves, some with their heads down, others with their legs sticking up in the air, with small creatures and birds having saved themselves on the floating carcasses. It was certainly dramatic, but it was to be a book for small children, and I decided that it went too far in its grisliness and left that part out. I always find it difficult to determine where that invisible line, the border between good taste and bad, runs, between the believable and the unbelievable, between the acceptable and the unacceptable, between the grim and the gruesome, between the necessary and the superfluous. But the pieces fell slowly into their proper place, and today it seems to me as if the book created itself, and I was the ever-present and interested observer. Whenever I finish a new book, I show it to my children to hear their reaction. In Noah's case, it was encouraging. They said, "It's all right." And that was the highest praise I could expect. This is not always the case. When I showed them my newest book, Oh, Were They Ever Happy, published last month, they told me that it was kid stuff, which of course it's supposed to be, and adding insult to injury, asked if it was really necessary to put our name on the cover. Some years ago, Lavinia Russ, then with Publishers Weekly, and I were asked to be the two judges for the picture book category for Bookworld's Children's Spring Book Festival Awards. I accepted, but later came to regret it, even though it was an education in its own right. It was great fun at first. The mailman delivered batches of new books every day, until I had well over 350 on the floor of my study. But that is where the fun ended and the judging began. At first it was easy, and without doing anyone an injustice, we could quickly discard a goodly proportion of the book. From that point on, it became more and more difficult. I believe that it was Winston Churchill who said that there was no book, even the most awful, that did not have something of value in it. And so it was, as we slowly and not very surely worked our way through those books, eliminating, weighing and judging. Who am I? I asked myself all the time, regretting that I had agreed to do the job, to judge the work of my peers, of people who take their work just as seriously and work as hard as I do on mine. I was also acutely aware that I was holding people's hopes, aspirations and ambitions in my hand, and my personal taste would be the only foundation on which my decision was made, this pile or that one. It was a painful task, and often Mrs. Russ and I went back to a book we had rejected, shaking our heads and put it back on the other stack, time and time again. But in the end, there were about 15 books left on the table. Each and every one was a beautiful, worthwhile, decent and distinguished book. Each one as worthy as the other 14. Each one equally deserving to win. My choices were made solely by personal taste and preference. And, curiously enough, while looking at them in all their differences, I realized that they were all books I secretly wished I could have done myself. When we finally decided on the winner and the runners-up, I was left with a distinct feeling of dissatisfaction and even distress. Not because of the books we had chosen, but because of the ones we had to leave behind. Noah must have felt the same way about the animals. And yet, there must be more to serious judging of this nature than only personal taste and experience. For the winner we selected was Brinton Turkle's Thy Friend Obadiah, and the first runner-up William Steig's Sylvester and the Magic Pebble, which a few months later won in the reverse, Sylvester the Caldecott and Obadiah an honor book. I have, very frankly, always had my doubts about the basis on which book prizes are awarded. I do not for a single moment believe that my Noah's Ark is the most distinguished picture book of the year. I believe, with a few memorable exceptions, that such a book doesn't exist. There are almost always a handful of books worthy of the distinction. Besides, if that book really existed and could be identified on an infallible basis, it would win every prize given that year. Yet, that never seems to happen. In years past, very few to be sure, awards have been given to books I felt to be unworthy of the honor, and there will be no doubt people who feel that way about this year's choice. When no one really outstanding book is published, I have wondered if some year's awards should not be passed up. The Nobel Prize for Peace, Chemistry or Medicine is not awarded some years. The most renowned and costly wines have good years and poor ones. And so do picture books. And perhaps in a year, in which there appears to be no single but several outstanding books, perhaps the prize should be divided among them. I do know that this was not the intention of Mr. Frederick Melcher. The Laura Ingalls Wilder Award, of course, is given to an author or illustrator for their contribution to literature over a period of years. Although I know it is the fate of some award-winning picture books to languish on library shelves, it is my hope and the end to which my efforts are really directed. To produce a book that not only pleases me, but also will be popular with children. So maybe I really want the impossible, the cake, and to eat it as well, even though I know that distinction and popularity do not automatically go hand in hand. I have by now kept you too long, but I would like to repeat, and this is no false modesty, that I did not for a moment believe Noah's Ark stood a ghost of a chance to win. I can hardly tell you how delighted I am with the great honor you've bestowed on me, and how happy I am to accept the Caldecott Medal. I'd like to think that it was given not for Noah only, but maybe a little for the books I did in the past as well. I thank you very, very much on behalf of Doubleday and of course myself, even if it all makes me feel somewhat melancholy. A slightly different outcome of your vote and Margot Zemak or David Macaulay would be standing where I stand now, not to mention those unnamed illustrators who are equally or more deserving than I. Thank you.